We have been looking at the book of Judges. And in the book of Judges, we see that the Jewish people were walking with God and things were prospering. And then somehow or some way, the next generation said, on God. They said, nah, that God that you're telling us about, he's not as much fun as these pagan gods. These pagan gods are blast. I mean, they got all these, this drinking and carousing and all this other stuff going on, and it's not only okay with those gods, but it's encouraged. It's how we worship those gods. Why should we care about this God that you're telling us about in our history? And so God proceeded then to explain to them why they should care. And that explanation was by the hands of the Canaanites and eventually the Midianites and the Philistines and the rest who came against Israel. And they learned firsthand how useless those gods were when they really needed them. In fact, those very gods were the gods of the people whom they were carousing with, and they were of no help whatsoever. So, turn with me to Judges chapter 4 and 5. I say chapter 4 and 5 because it's an interesting section of Scripture, because you have a prose account and a poetical account, and they are parallel accounts. And I struggled on how best to deal with these, and I think the best way to deal with these is kind of jump back and forth between chapter 4 and chapter 5. So let's start with chapter 4 in verse 1. This is a verse that you'll hear a lot in Judges. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, after Ehud died. Over and over again, as soon as a memory faded, as soon as things were going great, they walked away from God. We see that in modern times, time after time again. We see that in the life of our own country. I'm hoping that we're not done yet, but we're certainly at a low point. I don't know if it's as low as it gets in a cycle, or whether we've just driven off the cliff and it's a long way down. I'm hopeful, I'm prayerful that God will turn us around. Verse 2, and the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth HaGoyim. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. This wasn't just a year ago, this year or so. This was a whole generation. A whole generation. So this oppression was enough to drive them back to God. Now you'd say, iron chariots. What's so great about iron chariots? One bullet will take out that iron chariot. But in those days, they didn't have any bullets. One armored vehicle would crush that iron chariot, but they didn't have armored vehicles. In fact, the iron chariot was, in a sense, their armored vehicle. Picture, if you will, the way warfare was accomplished in those days, that you had basically foot soldiers. Their armor was very crude. It was, I think back then, they didn't even really have bronze armor. Maybe they had some of it, bronze plates, but most of it was leather. And you had this iron chariot with blades sticking out every angle of this thing, with this heavy war horse, which itself was formidable, charging down into a line of foot soldiers, and it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. There are a lot of things that were required in order to get to the point where you could make iron chariots. It wasn't like the Israelites could just build their own iron chariots. You needed to smelt iron, which required a great deal of expertise and trouble and materials, and the expertise to actually build these things so they wouldn't fall over, and the expertise to actually ride in one of these things. So it was a formidable army that they were against. And if there were bets being taken, the bets would be heavily upon Jabin's side, because they had the technology, they had the forces, and Israel had virtually nothing. Turn me to chapter 5. I just want to read chapter 6 and 7, or verse 6 and 7 of chapter 5. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anat, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry ceased, they ceased in Israel, till I, Deborah, arose, until I arose a mother in Israel. That kind of gives you the state of things. It wasn't like you had this armed Canaanite king up against these armed Israeli army. You had the armed Canaanite king against a downtrodden civilization. The Jewish people were definitely suffering. They were devastated. They were oppressed. All right, back to chapter 4, in verse 4. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, is what the New American Standard says, was judging Israel at that time. That verse is interesting. It's questionable. Some people translate a woman of bright lights instead of the wife of Lapidot, or a woman of shining or glowing or torches. In Hebrew, there is no word for wife. Commonly, you just say the woman of somebody, or my woman, and Ishi, my woman, is the same as my wife in Hebrew. So here it's Isha Lapidot, which could mean the wife of a man named Lapidot, although Lapidot is here feminine plural, so that would be a real stretch to call it a man's name, which is why some versions translate it a woman of brightness, or woman of torches, or woman of shining, which is another possible way of looking at it. Or it could have been a village named Lapidot, or she could be the woman, meaning an inhabitant of Lapidot. So we don't hammer your stake in the ground too hard as far as the fact that it is listed as the wife of Lapidot, because there are different ways to translate this. But Deborah was a prophetess, and she was judging Israel at the time. The only female judge that we know of Israel, but God still used her. As we have seen in the book of Judges, the role of a judge was not like we would think of a judge, of sitting behind a bench in a courtroom, but the judge would decide cases. But the judge would also lead the nation and lead people into battle when required. Verse 5, she used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to deliver Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. So Ephraim was where she was judging. The hill country, by the way, was a place where chariots were not very effective. So they were the Israel, it was a stalemate of sorts, that you had Israel up in the hills being oppressed but not overrun by the Canaanites, because the Canaanitish chariots were not effective in the hills, and the Jewish people not able to take out the Canaanites in the plains because the chariots were very effective down in the plains. Bear in mind, however, had the Jewish people done what they had been commanded to do when they had been commanded to do it, they wouldn't have had this problem, because all of this bit with the iron chariots seems to have arisen in the 100 or so years since the Exodus, when the Canaanites got their act together. And had Israel done what God had commanded and driven them out or killed all of them, then they wouldn't have had this problem, and they wouldn't have been isolated up in the mountains, up in the hills. So we have Deborah down in Ephraim, and we have Mount Tabor up in what was later to be known as the Galilee. And so the plan that Deborah gives to Barak is that Barak was going to take his forces up to Mount Tabor, then Deborah down here in Ephraim was going to go raiding against the Canaanite cities down in the plains from Ephraim. And when the Canaanite forces would come out, then the idea was that Barak and his forces would swoop down behind them and be successful in the battle. That was the battle plan. Barak throws a wrench into it in verse 8. Then Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go." So in other words, he's saying, I want you with me on the northern flank and not with the forces in Ephraim. She said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." And Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh. They're the two tribes that were around Mount Tabor up in the Galilee. And 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Za'anim, which is near Kadesh. Then they told Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor. So it's unknown whether this was a part of the plan or not, because it's basically Heber the Kenite, it sounds like, who spilled the beans, because he wasn't that far away from there. It could be spies or Kenites or who knows. Who knows? So verse 13, Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. So he called out his forces. Now, it was easier than they had thought, because Deborah didn't even have to have the forces raiding the cities in order to call them out. All right. So I'm looking at... Okay. I was looking back on chapter 5 to see if it sheds light on this. Not quite yet. Not quite yet. So seeing all of that, and most likely watching the weather, verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, "Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. So that was the battle plan. In order to get a better sense of the battle itself, let's turn to chapter 5, because that gives a better rendition of the battle, whereas chapter 4 gives a better rendition of the what followed after the battle. So in chapter 5, verse 1, then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang out that day, saying, "That the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered, bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I, to the Lord, I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. Lord, when we went out from Zair, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth quaked, the heavens also dripped, even the clouds dripped water. The mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord, this Sinai at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel. And the two verses are already read. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anat, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry ceased, they ceased in Israel, till I, Deborah, arose, until I arose a mother in Israel. New gods were chosen, then war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people, bless the Lord. So in other words, they're a ragtag band. Verse 10, you who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, you who travel on the road, sing. The sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places. There they shall recount the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his peasantry in Israel. The people of the Lord went down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and take away your captives, O son of Abinoam. The survivors came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came down to me as warriors. From Ephraim, those whose roots is in Amalek came down. Following you, Benjamin, with your peoples from Machir, commanders came down, and from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As was Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of hearts. So when God spoke to Deborah to take on the battle was engaged, and God entered the battle in several ways. It said that the earthquakes rocked the mountain, and it could either be symbolic or literal, that it could have been literal earthquakes, or it could have been that the sound of thunder was so loud that it was like earthquakes. And there's great storm, there was great waters that were coming down. Verse 16, why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben there were great searchings of heart. Gilead remained across the Jordan, and why did Dan stay in ships? Asher sat at the seashore and remained by its landings. Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death, and Naphtali also on the high places of the field. The kings came and fought, then fought the kings of Canaan at Tanakh near the waters of Megiddo. They took no plunder and silver. The stars fought from heaven, from their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon, O my soul, march on with strength. The horse's hooves beat from the dashing of his valiant steeds. So think iron chariots, think horses, think rain, think mud. Think chariots stuck in the mud. Think end of story for the Canaanites, because their technology, their war chariots, all of it was rendered useless in but a moment, because it was a flash flood of some sort. It had miraculous aspects to it, so it wasn't just your everyday flash flood. This was a flash flood to tell your grandchildren about, that encompassed those chariots, and the chariots were stuck fast. Verse 22, then the horses whose beat from the dashing, the dashing of his valiant steeds. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the warriors. So not all of Israel came to the call. So that was part of what that song is all about. You can see that their paganism and their walk away from God caused, in a sense, them to walk away from each other, to walk away from courage, to walk away from bravery and the things that needed to be done. Back to chapter 4, down at verse 15. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak, and Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. Most likely the chariots were not doing too well in the mud at that point. So rather than trying to rally his army like a commander ought to have done, he ran for his life. He ran for his life. And when you have an army running for its life, bad things happen to that army. Verse 16, but Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth HaGoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Yabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Yael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my master. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." He turned aside to her in the tent, and she covered him with a rug. He said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink. Then she covered him. A lot of mysteries abound in this section of what was going on. Because in one sense, she did what was right, but in another sense, she definitely invited Sisera into her tent, which was something that was a little odd for a woman of that time to do. She was obviously planning mayhem because she gave him milk instead of water. Because what do you do after you drink milk and you're tired and you're worn out and you're in a nice warm tent and a nice warm blanket over you? You go to sleep. Verse 20, he said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there anyone here?' that you shall say, 'No.'" And so it's not sure why she did what she did in verse 21. But Yael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand. This was, by the way, women's chore in that day, so it was not unusual. She took the tools at hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple and went through it into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted, so he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." He entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with a tent peg in his temple. So God subdued on that day Yabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel. The hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Yabin, the king of Canaan, till they had destroyed Yabin, the king of Canaan. So that whole confederacy came apart. And for 20 years they had peace, because the Canaanites were pretty much history at this point, that they are not going to be as the issue. Now other people are going to rise up and be an issue. All right, back to chapter 5, down in verse 24. It says, "Most blessed of women is Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl, she brought him curds. She reached out her hand for the tent peg and her right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he bowed, he lay, he fell, he lay. Between her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell dead. Out of the window she looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera, through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariots tarry? Her wise princesses would answer her. Indeed, she repeats her words to herself. Are they not finding, are they not dividing the spoil? A maiden, two maidens for every warrior. To Sisera a spoil of dyed work, a spoil of dyed and work embroidered, dyed work of double embroiderly on the neck of the spoiler." In other words, what she's saying is that she imagines the family of Sisera imagining what they're going to do with all the spoil that he's going to bring back from the battle. And it's not quite working out that way. Verse 31, "Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord. Let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might." And the land was undisturbed for 40 years. 40 years. 40 years. So, in verse, at the end of chapter 4, it said that they subdued it. In chapter 5, it was for 40 years. 40 years of peace that this bought them, because pretty much the Canaanite Confederacy was dead and buried. After this, it's going to be the Midianites and the Philistines that are going to be the problem. And there's some question about the Philistines, whether they were Canaanites or whether they were colonists from another part of the Mediterranean. But what can we see going on here in these passages. We see, first of all, that God can overcome any obstacle. Any obstacle whatsoever. Iron chariots, no problem. Canaanite confederacy, no problem. But yet, the people had to be obedient in order to take on these iron chariots. They had to have their hearts in the right place. God did not just take away these chariots. He did not just bring victory. God could have just done to Harosheth Hagoyim the same thing they did to Sodom and Gomorrah. Just rain down fire in the middle of the night and they'd be gone. Case closed. But he didn't. He chose men and women to step out in faith and to take on this difficult issue of these Canaanites, not just for God's sake, but for their own sake, so that they would, by this, see what faith can bring someone. We have that some people in Israel didn't answer the call. They didn't have the faith, they didn't have the courage. By walking and living among the Canaanites and forsaking their God, they no longer had the strength of character to do what God had commanded them to do. So we should not be surprised at all when we watch what's going on in our time, in our culture, in our country, as people are more out for themselves and less out for the common good, less and less out for God. But that's no excuse for the few who believe, who are faithful, in order to take on the banner of God, in order to do what God has asked us to do. In our day, it's not to get out our swords and to go off against the literal army, but it's rather to stand our ground and to take on those iron chariots all around us, in the society, in the difficult things that we have to do, being faithful to God, being obedient to what God has promised us, even as our culture around us becomes more and more disobedient and more scornful of those who desire to live righteous lives. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for all the ways that you have granted us victory in our lives against some very scary and formidable foes. I ask that you still would grant us courage, and more than courage, that you would open up our eyes, that we would understand our unrighteousness, that we would be driven to obey you, to seek out your righteousness and your solutions, that we should come out from among the evil all around us, that instead that our hearts would be fastened securely into your word and your principles and into a closer walk with you, so that we might be victorious in those battles in our lives that come across our path every single day, and that we might have victory in your eyes and in your way and for your sake and for the sake of our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.